This is Backstory, the show that explores the connections between America's past and present. I'm Peter Onuf, 18th Century History Guy.
I'm Ed Ayers, 19th Century History Guy.
And I'm Brian Ballow, History Guy of the 20th Century. Today on the show, we're celebrating the holiday season by historicizing it.
And you thought professors didn't know how to have a good time.
We're going to go to the phones now. We've been inviting your comments on today's topic on backstoryradio.org, and our producers have invited a few of the folks who left comments there to join us on the line.
We have Nathan on the line from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Nathan, welcome to Backstory.
Thank you.
So tell us, what's on your mind today?
Well, I've been wondering why Christmas. Technically, Easter is the highest holiday in the Christian religion.
Right.
And yet, the way it's celebrated, by comparison, it seems like a minor holiday.
Whoa, that's a tough one. My idea would be that we're a very sentimental, self-centered people. Individualism is the big thing. And in our personal high holy day calendar, our birthdays are way up there. I think the idea that Jesus had a birthday is both the macro version of our micro, hey, we got birthdays, he's got a birthday. Now, think about it. It's a way in which the calendar of our lives, I think, intersects so meaningfully with a sacred calendar. And it's one of Easter, of course, is very important. It's a rebirth day, you might say, right? Mm-hmm. Being born again is certainly centrally important in the evangelical tradition, but being born in the broader Christian tradition is way up there.
Wow. What a good answer. You know, I think there's something to the sweetness of the story of the manger and the wise men, you know, and it's a little more accessible to children than rebirth and resurrection and all of those sort of things. And I think it, my answer owes something to yours, Peter. It's a birthday is as close to a universal experience, I guess, as we have. And it's also very democratic, I think, you know, that Jesus could be born in a manger. And so it's accessible, I think, in that way as well.
Yeah, no, that's a good point, because even the most modest home can seem like a fitting place for the commemoration of this great birth that we're celebrating, right?
Yeah, you know, despite, you know, all the language about kings and the Lord of Lords and all this, he's a little baby.
And so it's a family story.
Yeah, exactly. Now, there's a danger in the way we're talking, which is to make it sound like this was all planned. And of course, it wasn't.
No.
It's not as if some people sat in a boardroom at Macy's and thought, you know, how can we move a lot of merchandise by a holiday that's going to, you know. But there was something about the 19th century that made it seem like a good idea, you know, to take something that had been suppressed and even disapproved of by Puritan forebears and turn it into something important.
Right. And I think the key thing in what you're saying is it's the family taking a certain form in the 19th century that makes this holiday resonate more than any other.
Yeah, it makes it make sense.
Right. And I think it's the convergence of both religious faith, because the 19th century is a very Christian.
Well, and I want to ask about faith, and I'm doubly challenged now, being Jewish and being 20th century. But towards the end of the 19th century, doesn't God become a friendlier, more loving God? Isn't this part of what becomes the social gospel?
Well, I think what we're talking about, Brian, the domestication of and sentimentalization of Christmas, the central focus on the Christ child and on the birth, all of that, I think, mediates the awesomeness and awfulness of the Calvinist Christian God of Jonathan Edwards' time.
Right. But theologically, the religion itself is kind of changing in the way it's understood.
Well, you know, think in a Protestant culture, you don't have the benefit of the Virgin Mary to perform these mediatory role. And I think, in a way, the sentimentalized Jesus performs that role in a Protestant culture.
Oh, that's very interesting.
So, Nathan, we've been suggesting the answer to your excellent question is that you want to know why a holiday takes on the significance it now has. You have to look at a crucial moment in our historical experience when the stars are in the right alignment and everything from the marketplace, commerce, Christianity to notion of a midwinter break.
Yeah, and Nathan, here's a hot tip. Keep your eye on Purim. I think it's moving up fast.
All right.
Thanks a lot, Nathan.
Thank you.
Thanks, Nathan.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Next up on the line, we've got David in Brooklyn, New York. David, welcome to Backstory.
Hello, everybody.
What do you have for us today, David?
I really have like an economic question related to Christmas. I wonder, it seems that the kind of story we get from the government and the media, and I mean, I don't mean to make it sound conspiratorial like that, but the story you hear is that the economy might fail if these 30 days, you know, from Thanksgiving to Christmas or whatever, don't go well. And I wonder for how long it's been billed as like a driving engine of the economy.
David, I have one acronym for you.
Yes?
SPUG, the Society for the Prevention of Useless Giving.
Yeah.
And this is a progressive era society in the teens of the 20th century. And already back then, they're really worried about this commercialization. Now, I'm not sure they viewed it as a maker or breaker of the economy the way we do today, but think of that, the Society for the Prevention of Useless Giving.
Wow.
But it is true that a large portion of retail trade is over the extended holiday season.
40%?
David, my dad owned a jewelry store. I worked in that jewelry store every Christmas season. He did half his business during the Christmas, Hanukkah season.
I guess my question is, when did this become a civic duty to do this kind of thing? It's our, you know, kind of like... after 9/11, you know, go shopping, and that's what we were left with, you know.
I'd say the roots of that, David, are in the 1930s when even unions and certainly automobile manufacturers began to make the case to their workers, hey, you don't just work at GM or Ford.
Mm-hmm,
you're
mm-hmm.
not just workers, you're consumers as well. Now, they use that to argue that the government should provide various subsidies, particularly for health care, to these kinds of workers. But it's really the 30s that economists and business leaders begin to talk about the responsibility of workers to also consume the products that they're producing. Now, it really takes off after World War II, but I would place the origins of it in the 1930s.
And do you think that because of this kind of formulation from the 1930s, like actual good has come out of this for you and me?
That depends on what you're giving me for Hanukkah, David.
I mean, has it actually helped create prosperity, or is it just like a bunch of crap that we get and dump in the landfill?
Both. It's created prosperity by producing a lot of crap.
Has it made us happy, you might ask? Has it enriched our civic culture?
Yes.
And I'd say there's a profound tension in being enjoined to wasteful consumption. Of course, they wouldn't say it's wasteful. Just consume, consume.
I don't know. If I get some more acetone or gloves, I'll be pretty darn happy.
Okay, well, this is going to show how deeply affected and infected we are with the consumer culture. We're going to spend the rest of your call listing our things that we want. But we got what we wanted, David. We got a good call from you. And so thanks.
Well, thank you,
and
guys.
And holiday best wishes to you.
Okay, you too.
Thank you, David.
Take care, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Soon will come our way.
Santa very soon will come our way.
Eight little reindeers pull a sleigh.
Santa's little reindeer pull a sleigh.
Reindeer sleigh, come our way.
Ho, ho, ho.
Cherry nose, cap on head.
Susan's red,
special night. Here's this right.
Must be Santa.
Must be Santa.
Must be Santa.
Santa Claus.
One day around Christmas in the mid-70s, a teenager named Tyrone Jones was walking down the street in West Philadelphia when he saw a most unusual sight. A fat man in a Santa Claus costume. Okay, fine. But the fat man was African American. Tyrone couldn't believe his eyes. It had never crossed his mind that Santa could be black. Well, three decades later, the idea is about as ho-hum as it could be for him. And that's because Tyrone, who himself is African American, is now the official Santa in residence at the Cheltenham Square Mall in North Philadelphia. I called up Tyrone and I asked him how he decided to start donning the red suit.
I love kids. I love children. Uh-huh. I love them to death. Even where I live now, they knock on the door and ask, can I come out to play? And I'm 50.
You're 50 years old.
I'm 50 years old.
Yeah.
And then 9 and 10 ask, can I come out and play? And I've got this white beard. And I'm a big guy. You know, and everybody was saying I could be Santa Claus. You Santa Claus.
So they actually told you that?
Yeah, they'll tell me I'm Santa Claus. They'll tell me that now.
Now, what are the reactions of the kids to you? You're a black Santa, and is that something that you're aware of? Is that something you know, you've noticed? Or is it just like any other Santa?
I think kids like this. They see a red costume and a beard. And they, Santa! They go, I don't think it's so much a black and white at that time as little kids. No, I don't.
How about the parents, though? Do you have reason to believe that some people go to Cheltenham Mall just because you are a black Santa and that's somewhat unusual?
Right, correct, correct. I do believe that. Because one guy, even when I was time to go, I'm almost out of my uniform, and the girl knocks on the door, and the guy said, look, please, can you come out? I've been all over trying to find a black Santa. Please, can you do this for me? You know? And I did it. Whatever, so...
And when you try to make each kid's experience special, is that something that has race connected with it? Do you feel particularly strongly towards a black kid, or are you kind of colorblind in that regard?
I'm colorblind in that capacity. Mm-hmm. I don't, you know, kids are kids. At that age, kids are kids. They don't know nothing about that, and I'm not going to be the one that projects that image to them. You know, I show them all the same love.
I'm sure that you do. But that said, do you wish that there were more black Santas out there?
I wish it was more caring Santas. I wish it was more caring Santas.
Yeah, no, that's a really terrific. Yeah. Well, look, what do you do with a shy kid or the kid who's scared? Do you have certain techniques?
Yeah. See, me, I'm not your traditional Santa. You know, I'm not your traditional Santa. I just don't sit there and ask you what you want. I'm a dancing Santa. I love to dance.
Dancing Santa? Yeah, you really are an unusual Santa.
I'll dance my heart out for you just to make you smile.
That's got to break the ice.
Yeah. And once they see that, and I point to my box and they hit my music and I do my Santa dances, oh, my God, it's so fun. It is such a glorious time. Oh, it's so exciting to see the kid's face light up, though, for real. It is so exciting.
Mr. Jones, what is the most unusual request that you've gotten from a kid for a gift?
Well, I wouldn't say it's unusual. It's just sometimes it really makes me sad when they say all they want for Christmas is their mommy and daddy to get back together.
That's very tough.
Yeah.
Does that happen very often?
Sure, sure.
What do you tell them?
Well, I say when Santa elves get out of line or one of the reindeers act up, Santa just prays and asks a higher power than Santa, you know, to try to make that happen, you know?
Yeah.
So I just try to be uplifting.
Of course you do, but that's also sounds like good advice for those kids.
That's the best I can come up with.
Well, that's pretty good. I honestly don't know how many kids listen to our show, but I'd like to give you the chance to do a shout out to all those kids who are gearing up for their visit to Santa. Do you have any advice for them?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. Number one, always listen to mommy and daddy. Number two, try to stay in school and do the best you can. And number three, eat those vegetables. You need them vegetables. And then Santa will definitely come, send me down the chimney and give you one of these great big, for Christmas.
Well, Mr. Jones, that's terrific. And the broccoli growers of America also appreciate this. I want to thank you for spending all this time. And my kids are grown up. And even though I'm a white guy, my kids are African American. And I know that it may not make much difference to you, but I wish there had been a black Santa like you around when my kids were little. And I would have taken them to see you. I really appreciate you spending the time with us.
Thank you very much for saying that. glad to be there because, like, it's all about the kids.
Okay. Now you eat your vegetables, okay?
Yeah. Okay.
All right. Bye-bye.
Yeah, I'm going to feed the reindeer.
Bye-bye.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
That's Tyrone Jones. You can find him as his alter ego, Santa Claus, at the Cheltenham Square Mall in Philadelphia.
You know, I'm almost tempted to drive to Cheltenham Square Mall just to meet him, because it seems to me that he really embodies what's best about all these holiday traditions, you know, that we find new ways, no matter how history changes, to celebrate the family, tradition, each other.
Yeah, and I think he really represents the way this country changes and the way, not that African Americans weren't here, but the way that they are now engaged in mainstream culture, especially consumer culture. But, you know, we talked earlier in the show about the influence of Germans coming over mm-hmm. here. We talked about the ways in which Jews adapted to the rise of Christmas as that mega holiday, upgrading the quality of Hanukkah. And this story about Black Santa Claus, yeah. I think, says a lot about both what it is to be American and what it is to celebrate a holiday in America.
Yeah, well, Brian, it's a way in which something that we take from our past, the idea of Santa Claus, and it has a timeless past for us, can be changed. And so that the changes that we as historians are discovering in the past are actually a very hopeful preview of what we can be doing in the future. Love that Santa Claus. I'm going to go with Ed up there to Philadelphia.
Well, I'll tell you what, guys. I'm joining you on the backstory bicycle built for three. We'll all go up to Philadelphia.
All right. Cool.
That's all the time we have for today's show. Visit us online to continue the conversation. Leave us a comment, and we'll do our best to respond. We're at backstoryradio.org. Sign up for a free podcast there and friend us on Facebook.
It's all at backstoryradio.org. Thanks for listening. And may your new year be a good one.